Hey Fresh Capital listeners, in this episode, we are talking about one of my favorite under-the-radar companies, C Limited. C is one of Singapore's biggest companies, but it often gets lost behind Western juggernauts like Amazon, Apple, and Google. C operates across mobile gaming, e-commerce, and digital finance. So it's like a mashup of Blizzard, Activision, Amazon, and Square. It's a bit like Alibaba, but for Southeast Asia rather than China. There's a lot to talk about here, so let's dive in to one of Asia's most exciting companies. Listen and enjoy. Welcome to another episode of Fresh Capital. Every week, we provide a refreshingly simple way to learn about companies and investing. My name is Dan. And as always, I'm joined by my fidgety friend, Albert. Albert, what are you doing?
I'm just trying to move a few things around, like my coffee. I'm trying to like make sure my phone's charging because I forgot to charge it last night. Every time we record the podcast, because I don't have a dedicated like desk in my room, I've got to like move everything. It's like I'm actually sitting on the ground and, you know, this is my bedside table that I perched my laptop on. And where I'm sitting now, my armchair is normally because my bookshelf is here. So I've got to like move everything around. So right now there's just like crap all over the floor that I'm just moving around.
The Fresh Capital Studio could use a bit of a revamp, couldn't it?
Oh, for sure. I've been putting off buying a desk for my bedroom for months, and I probably should buy one now that, you know, the summer break's coming and I've got a bit of free time.
You should. Any plans for the summer break? This is my last week in Sydney before I head off to Canberra. For the family sort of gathering.
Oh, nice. When do you head back?
Saturday
yeah,
morning.
Yeah, very cool. I'll probably go to Canberra the week after next and, you know, spend a couple of days there. But aside from that, nothing crazy. I don't have a big break off work. I think I've just taken the week between Christmas and New Year's off. What about you?
I've got until Jan 10, so it's actually going to be quite a long one. But, you know, no rest for the wicked, Albert. There's a reason why you don't get the time off and I do.
No, I feel like I'm actually at that stage now. I don't know whether you feel it as well, but it's been a hard year. It's been a long year. I'm definitely feeling a bit burnt out. So potentially we'll take a few more days off.
No comment on that one. I've had an okay year. But let's talk about the company that we're looking at today, Albert, C Limited. This has been one I've really wanted to do for a while because obviously I've got Indonesian roots, Southeast Asian roots. And so it's a company that's been somewhat on my radar. And I think just in, I hate to categorize the world between West and East, but definitely in certain investment circles, I don't think C gets as much love as it should. Do you want me to run the breakdown or the overview? Or
no,
do you want to
please,
go for
Dan.
It?
I think this is a good company in your wheelhouse. I actually didn't really know C particularly well. Like I've seen some of these logos that sit within C, but you know, thank you for suggesting this because it's a super interesting business.
Well, the other thing which doesn't do any favors is its name is kind of generic. So if you type C into Google, you can come up with all sorts of other companies. But this is the one that's listed on the NASDAQ. It's a global consumer internet company, which is actually, it's the reason that it's got such a general brand over it is because it's got three pretty distinct spheres of competence where they operate with their businesses. They've got digital entertainment, which they do through their Garena platform. That offers mobile and PC online games across Southeast Asia. And it's really, really big in the mobile games market. So that's one segment. The second segment is e-commerce, where they've got Shopee. And then the third segment is finance, digital payments, which is C Money. So when I was sort of thinking about this, if you mash together a Blizzard Activision for games, an Amazon for e-commerce, and then like a Square for digital payments, that's what C is. It's all three of these businesses sort of lumped into one. So it's a really fascinating business. Anything you want to add to that one, Albert?
Yeah, I think the other thing I'd put out is it started as Garena, so their gaming business. And they've really carried on a gaming philosophy throughout the other parts of the business. And we'll talk about it during the pod. But they've basically gamified parts of their Shopee business as well. embodying the philosophies that they learned from Garena into other parts of their business.
Yeah, and it's almost all with the principle in mind that it's a mobile-first sort of business, mobile-first platform, and that goes across, obviously, mobile payments, but also e-commerce, which is increasingly trying to get to people's mobiles, and then games too, which we'll break down a little bit further. But Albert, let's do some quick hits. What do you have?
Yeah, so you know, as we talk about C, I always abbreviate Southeast Asia as C, so this is a bit confusing writing my own notes as well. They've got what they call the big six of gaming countries, which are C's largest customers, but also generally countries that have the largest gaming adoption: Vietnam, Thailand, Philippines, Indonesia, Malaysia, and Singapore. These big six countries are driving, you know, the highest gaming adoption rates in Asia.
Excellent. So one of the quick hits I wanted to get off is C-Money. I don't think we're really going to get into C-Money just because there's so much to talk about on their e-commerce and their gaming side. And it is the smallest segment out of the three. But they've got 39 million quarterly paying users, which is quite a lot. And their total payments volume is 12 billion. I always like to contextualize some of these numbers, and I found this actually quite interesting. So their total payments volume, that's the amount of people transacting using C-Money, is about $12 billion. Square is about 10 times that, at $112 billion. So you can get an idea of the scale of their business compared to Square. PayPal is over $900 billion. I didn't realize the gap between PayPal and Square was that big. And then as I was just thinking about it, I was like, oh, I should look up Visa and MasterCard. Visa is 2.7 trillion, so about 2.5 times the size of PayPal. So these are the magnitudes of scale of the payment providers that we use day to day. It's quite fascinating.
Yeah, it is crazy. I think that broadly makes sense when you think about what segments they start in, where Square predominantly started in like small to medium businesses and is trying to push upwards into market, where, you know, because Visa, PayPal, et cetera, are incumbent businesses, they really started in the top end of town enterprise. But, you know, where we're getting sidetracked. The other thing I'd add to C-Money is that, you know, although we're not talking about them, because of how localized each of the countries that C operates in, you know, we talked about those big six: Singapore, Malaysia, Thailand, Indonesia, Philippines, Vietnam. They all have different financial regulations and different, you know, adoption of digital banking, banking more broadly. There's different levels of maturity when it comes to their financial systems. And so C actually have very tailored services and products in each of those countries as a result of that. So it's a highly localized service offering rather than a one-size-fits-all service offering, which again, you know, will come out of a lot of our discussions when you talk about C and how they operate in all these different markets.
Well, let's not keep the listeners waiting, Albert. We're basically going to break down their two larger segments, which is going to be gaming and e-commerce. Albert, which do you want to start with? And you take
I think we should start with gaming. I think, you know, this forms a majority of C's financial performance. It subsidizes the rest of the business. To me, it's probably the more interesting part of their business because, you know, we've talked about e-commerce a lot, where gaming is something we have talked about, but probably not as much as, you know, either of you would have liked, either of us would have liked.
Go for it.
Yeah, great. So, you know, like I mentioned, C originally started as its gaming brand, Garena. Garena founded in 2009, and C is a business IPO'd in 2017 and really broke through in market when it secured the rights to publish League of Legends in Southeast Asia. So, Dan, I'm not a big League fan. I know my younger brother is a big League fan. He's going to listen to this. I saw his Spotify Wrapped the other day, and he was in the top 0.05% of people who listen to the League of Legends soundtrack on Spotify. So, shout out to my younger brother. But now where Garena is at is they're basically a one-size or a one-stop shop for gaming distribution in the region. They have a kind of a portfolio of games, you know, including FIFA, Call of Duty Mobile, PUBG. They also have a strategic partnership with Tencent to distribute the games that Tencent make in Southeast Asia. So you can really think of them as a Southeast Asian gaming publisher who pick and choose different games to publish in the region.
Yeah, I mean, so let's break that down a little bit. So I guess there's two different models, which Greener play in both. One is, as you say, Albert, you can take a game from another provider and you can basically be the licensee to distribute it in a particular location. The other way, as we'll get into, is if you just create your own game and you distribute it through the region. Now, it doesn't take a genius to know the second is the more profitable route because you're not paying fees to the original creator of the game. You would own all the IP if you created it yourself and you can get a lot of profit from that. And spoiler, they have had a sort of runaway hit called Free Fire, which is generating a lot of their profit. But as you say, Albert, they started off as essentially distributing other people's games into the region. You might ask, why do gaming publishers do this? Why would a Riot Games or a Tencent basically hand over their IP to someone else? And it goes down to, it's really tough to distribute things in different locations. Like, language is a barrier, culture is a barrier. Sometimes it's easier if you've got a local player who knows the region to do all the hard yards of marketing, trying to drive up users, and you just take a fee for that service, essentially.
Yep.
And there's also the esports component of things. So Riot Games is, I think, one of the largest esports in the world. They, you know, sell out the Bird's Nest in China when it was still there before it got demolished. With their finals for their esports league. What Garena also does, they take that as well. So they are responsible for the esports ecosystem in these countries in Southeast Asia. And so they host live events, they run the competitions as a way, it's a marketing sort of tool to build up more users on the platform. So that's another reason why publishers give over to these third party distributors.
Yeah, and mobile and cloud gaming has really changed how game makers and content makers really distribute games because, you know, you're right, Dan, marketing is different, culture's different, gaming adoption's different, you know, but the underlying infrastructure is incredibly different. Trying to launch any cloud business, whether it's gaming or cloud software, from an infrastructure perspective is really different to launching in Australia versus the US versus, say, China, where they've got different cloud providers, they've got different hosting challenges, you know, they've got incredibly different cloud infrastructure, which is really hard to navigate if you, you know, only really understand how to launch a cloud business in the US. So handing it off to a company who has the expertise in the region is, you know, a way better use of funds, and you're happy to take the clip. On, you know, Garena's different gaming portfolios, they've got, I guess, two games within their portfolio that they have actually created. Free Fire, which you've just spoke about, and Heroes of Newerth, which, you know, was published by or developed by S2 Games, but now that's been acquired by Garena.
So if we go into Free Fire, which is really the main game, they hit over 100 million daily players last year, which obviously had a bit of a COVID bump as people were at home with the pandemic. But, you know, if I were to describe the game, it's in the same line of really popular battle royale games. It lets up to 50 players parachute into an island area where they fight each other. Sounds pretty familiar. It's the same sort of idea behind PUBG, behind Fortnite. So it's not groundbreaking, I think, in what it does. It's all in the execution. And one of the key things is it's a mobile game. And when you're looking at the Southeast Asian audience, they have low to mid-range devices. They don't have lots of storage space. They don't generally play on computers. So having a mobile way for them to game, which can run smoothly, can run effectively, was what made this sort of like a runaway hit. And it was one of the most downloaded mobile games for the last year or two. You're just running
straight.
Yeah,
it's crazy. In 2019 and 2020, it was the most downloaded mobile game in the world, which, like, if you think about the six countries who play it, or the majority of the six countries who play it, those big six, they've basically propelled this game twice in a row to be the most downloaded mobile game in the world. And people joke about Candy Crush or whatever, but no one, I've never played Free Fire. I don't know many people who joke about playing Free Fire over Candy Crush, but, like, that to me is a crazy stat.
Yeah, and it shows how games and app downloads are really localized. Like, you can have an incredibly popular app in your region, and then in another region they just have never heard about it, and they've got their equivalent. And that's where C is playing, or Green is playing here with their gaming segment. I think the question that we picked up on, Albert, is what you sort of mentioned at the top, is that the gaming segment is sort of subsidizing the other segments. So they actually turn a profit. So for the third quarter, they had about, I think it's 70 million or 700 million in profits. And that directly correlates with their losses from the e-commerce segment. So it's obviously really profitable that they've got this game, which hundreds of millions of people play. They sell, it's a free game, but they sell skins and items and those sorts of things in-game to turn money and get revenue. But all that revenue is just getting sucked up by the e-commerce side of things. So do you want to talk about what's happening on the e-commerce side of C?
Yeah, I love, now that we're talking about this as a portfolio business, there's like a classic view of how a company should map out its portfolio companies or its business units that was really made famous by BCG. They call it the growth share matrix. And the idea of the growth share matrix is you really want to plot each parts of your business portfolio on a matrix that talks about cash generation versus, growth. It is a good way to understand what part of your businesses are performing really well. And they've got four quadrants, and you want to put each of your businesses on each of the quadrants. You know, the first is if you've got a business in a high market growth area generating high cash, you call them stars. Now, ideally, you want to continue to invest in that business. Then you've got businesses that have a low cash generation, but the market itself is growing quite high. You know, you want to understand whether you should stay in that business or not. You've got high cash generation, but low usage, and then low cash generation and low market share, which means you want to divest out of that. You can plot this two businesses, Shopee, which is C's e-commerce business, and Garena, which is their gaming business, onto the growth share matrix and really understand how the business is working. You've got their cash cow, which is Garena, and then they've got their kind of star, which is Shopee, and they're really taking money from Garena to subsidize Shopee and continue to invest in its growth. And the reason for that is Garena itself is a highly cash flow positive business. You know, when you talk about gaming, you host the game and then they manage to add new content here and there, but really, like, users are paying or contribute money to play the game, and it costs very little marginal effort and marginal resources to add more users. And so because Garena is highly cash flow positive, C can redirect some of that money towards Shopee to help scale and grow that business. And we could talk about Shopee at great length, but from a portfolio construction perspective, I really like that C are doing this because it means they can use one high-performing part of their business to grow and invest in other parts of their business with the view that eventually that also becomes a high-growth, high-cash flow positive business to then continue investing in other parts of their business.
So if we look at Shopee, I mean, can you even just describe it? It's a pretty common nowadays e-commerce marketplace, but you mentioned there's some gamification behind it, Albert. Do you want to go further on that?
Yeah, so, before I jump into that, so Shopee really came out of Garena. So the other part of Garena is it's like a chat streaming platform. And so what C had found, or Garena had found at the time, were people were using the chat service and the streaming service to sell things to each other. And so they saw how users were interacting on their chat and decided to build out Shopee, firstly as a consumer-to-consumer marketplace business, kind of like the OG eBay. And now it's kind of transformed into a classic B2C e-commerce business, you know, as they do now, like Amazon or Alibaba. And what Shopee do is they enable very easy, classic, you know, companies or businesses to sell to consumers. But what they build into that is this gamification where they've got Shopee coin, where people can earn coins like loyalty coins or loyalty points to shop. They've got live streams where people can put live streams on all their products and you can come in and see what the products are. they've got Shopee games where they start little games within the Shopee platform to incentivize people to buy things. And then they've got Shopee Feed, which is like a social media feed where you can see what other people are buying on Shopee. So they've built not only gamification around if you buy more things, you can level up. You know, there's different mini games that scores you discounts. They've also built a social element through their live streams and their social media. Like Dan just bought, you know, a pair of sunglasses. I can like that and be like, nice one, Dan. They look good. Or Dan, they look shit. What are you doing? It's raining.
Yeah, that's a good overview. And I think when we talk about how are they losing money on this business segment, it's actually quite easy to contextualize because when you're selling through this online marketplace, as we've talked about in many of our previous episodes, the marketplace just takes a clip for every single transaction that occurs. So if shoes are sold for $100 on the platform, then that retailer who's using the platform will maybe pay $5 to the platform for the use of the marketplace. So it's a very high margin. So once you pay for those hosting costs, you basically just get this continuous source of money coming in. Where the costs sort of come out, just as I mentioned with the hosting costs, you've sort of got the setup, which is particularly in a market like Southeast Asia, I don't think it should be underestimated. You really have to educate some of these retailers, some of these mom and pop stores who want to sell online, how to use the marketplace. Like they actually go into great depth in their sort of annual reports and other materials to talk about how they've got whole teams which go out to educate people on how to take a photo of the goods that they're selling so that it's nice and presentable to customers, how to discount things, how to use the online tools, how to track sales flow and who's coming onto their part of the marketplace. So there is, where with an underdeveloped market in a sense for online retail, a whole education process which Seeders have to undertake so that it can sort of grow into the future as more and more users come on. That's a cost. The other cost is they have to compete with other marketplaces. So when Sea came along, there was a incumbent called Lazada, which is an Alibaba-backed e-commerce marketplace. And when you think about, well, how do you get people to stop buying on Lazada and come to Shopee? You do things like you offer discounts. You do things like you offer free shipping, priority shipping. You market it so it's on every single bus stop or every single train station. All those things cost money. And I think I've read some analysis where when you really dive into Shopee's e-commerce business, the business itself is profitable. It's fine. It's all of the marketing, all the other stuff, which is making it unprofitable at this moment, which in some ways, as we've talked about, Albert, is justifiable because there's a very clear payoff. You're trying to get market share so that in the future, you're in this really dominant position where then you can get the profits coming
in. Yeah, and that's really showing in, you know, Shopee's penetration where it has become, you know, the number one or number two e-commerce platform in, you know, those big six countries we talked about. You know, it really is starting to overtake Lazada in a lot of different countries. It's overtaken Lazada in even most downloads. So it is starting to gain traction. It is interesting that, you know, as we're talking about trying to attract different customers and the take rate. So Shopee's take rate is about 6%, where Amazon, Alibaba, et cetera, they've got much higher take rates. So they're really trying to attract more and more users through a lower take rate. The other thing is they make actually very little margin on their e-commerce platform because they've subsidized a lot of things. Like they've subsidized discounts, they've subsidized free shipping, they're trying to educate the market on shipping and acquire more customers. So they're happy to sacrifice what that margin looks like because they're really trying to get more and more customers onto that Shopee platform, which, as you know, a choice and a decision that they've made, is working out for them because their customers are growing. You know, from Q3 2020 to Q3 now, which is the trailing 12 months, they've gone from 0.7 billion in gross orders to 1.7 billion, so about 120% year-on-year growth. They've also seen close to that 80% gross merchandise volume, so that's the amount of items sold from a value perspective, grow from about 9 billion to 17 billion. So this choice for them has really started to pay off.
Yeah, and I really wanted to dive into that tailwind I mentioned, which is Southeast Asia is a growing marketplace. They've got to educate it. Forecasts are that online spending is going to grow 4 to 6-fold by 2030. And what that looks like is about $175 billion is spent today online spend in Southeast Asia. And that's going to be $1 trillion in 10 years. So like the reason you're investing in this growth now is because if you're not investing in growth and you just focus on profitability now, you could be a really profitable third largest marketplace at the moment. But what you really want is to be the number one player when the market is way bigger 10 years from now, and your profits will sort of outstrip that. Then it's sort of, when I think about the analogy, Albert, it's sort of when you come out of university, you're so worried about your salary compared to everyone else, where if you think, oh, I'm just going to invest in my education a little bit more now, 10 years from now, my promotion or whatever is going to be worth way more than whatever the difference between my salary and the other grads right now. Like, you're sort of investing in getting a much bigger profit down the road. Yeah,
exactly. So, you know, if you in Australia start university, you start off in debt, and you hope that the education will make up for the fact that you're, you know, tens of thousands of dollars in debt in high earnings. And, you know, you can't really apply that same thinking because I don't know if it's equal, but it's the same for high growth businesses. You're happy to invest to be negative in terms of profitability because you hope that once you get market share and once you've outstripped and outlasted all your competitors, that you can be highly profitable and highly cash flow positive. And that's a trend that we've seen a lot of companies take now. Like Tesla is a really good example of this, where they were highly unprofitable and, you know, probably could have gone bankrupt at some point. But now they're at that stage now where they've finally started to become even the tiniest bit profitable after a long period of time.
The last number I'll throw in is that if you want to compare the development of, say, a Southeast Asia to a North America, internet penetration in North America is about 95%. Internet penetration in Southeast Asia is about, you know, 75%. So there's such room to grow. And if you just think of the population size of Southeast Asia as well, there's a big, big runway. But Albert, that leads to the obvious next question, which is there may be runway, there may be this wonderful market there. You've got a great product even, but how do you fare against competition? What do you see there?
This is a good question and something I want to throw back to you, Dan, is when we're talking about Roblox, you asked about how enduring is Roblox as a game or like as a platform. Like, you know, you talked about games, some games being enduring like FIFA, etc., some games not being particularly enduring. And Roblox had been around since 2005, so the argument I put forward was like, it's a 16-year-old platform, it's enduring. And for the most part, a lot of games don't last more than 4 years. Like, I've got a statistic somewhere in my notes where the majority of games don't last for longer than 4 years. And the ones that do become like cornerstone franchises, Grand Theft Auto, Call of Duty, FIFA, etc. Free Fire started in 2016, now hit the 4-year-old mark. There's a few other competitors they have within that same gaming segment, PUBG and Fortnite. And now Call of Duty have started their own Battle Royale game. I can't remember what it's called, but I've seen Nick Kyrgios play it a lot on his Instagram. Where do you see Free Fire in the gaming landscape? Is it going to be an enduring game?
No, I don't think it will be. You can see that in some of the moves they've made. Like, they've already looked to do a bit of a reboot, which is Free Fire Max, which is playable on sort of PCs. So the Max being like for higher graphics, those sorts of things. Really, the way analysts think that Free Fire is going to go is you're probably going to license it out in other areas where it's not at the moment. So US, where they don't really have Free Fire, you could really get penetration there. It'll be new, it'll be different. And it can really expand on the learnings you have from such a large player base here in Southeast Asia. And that way you can keep it fresh sort of year over year. It's the same way that Korean dramas and things might get released to Western audiences years after they were popular in Korea and get a bit of a second run and a second lift behind it, second wind. But if you ask me like 10 years from now, is anyone going to be paying Free Fire? No, they're just inherently they won't be. And it's not a game which has what you'd call meta changes. So the concept of games is usually, you know, you've got a Mario Party 1 and then maybe next year they release a Mario Party 2. That's one type of game concept where you're constantly releasing updated versions with new content. The other way that games go is they have what's called a meta, which is, I think, most efficient way of playing. There's an acronym there somewhere. But the idea being that you've just got a really complex and sophisticated game which organically changes with the player base as users find new ways to do things the best possible way. So that might be when it's first released, the Albert character was super overpowered. It was the easiest way to win at the game was to use Albert. And then a couple of years later, we find out that the best counter to Albert is Dan. And now all the users are using Dan as the playable character to win the game. And so you can actually get new novelty, new ways of playing organically through the game. To cut a long story short, you know, Free Fire is not that kind of game. League of Legends is that kind of game. They have very conscious meta changes. They've got a pool of like over 100 unique characters with different abilities. So you can have an ecosystem where meta changes really take place. Free Fire is not that. So it depends on them creating a new game, which they have zero track record of. So I'm a bit worried about that, Albin. What do you reckon?
I think there is a meta in Free Fire. I think it's less explicit than a game like League of Legends or Dota, where you have a range of different characters and each character has a unique skill. Like, the meta exists in how you play the game. And, you know, I don't play Free Fire, but, you know, analogous game, Fortnite, which just got to level 99 and that's one of the highest levels. And lets you unlock all the skins, etc. For that particular season. But... you know, the meta exists in terms of the weapons that you use and the gameplay. You know, within each part of the game, they change it up. They change the map. They change the weapons. They change how you can play the game. They add different functionalities. And so the meta is probably less explicit, but they do change the game and innovate what the game looks like in terms of the weapons you can use, what the map looks like, different movements, etc. The other thing that they keep fresh is they offer skins. And this is where I think Free Fire really stands out, is that it offers localized skins based on the region that you play. At the moment, if you play Fortnite, you can really only buy the skins that are one-stop shop shows. Like, you can buy... I recently just bought, for any anime fans, the Sasuke skin, because Fortnite and Naruto had a collaboration. So bought that. They've also got like John Wick skins, etc. Whereas for Free Fire, because the countries that they're in are so localized and, you know, so cultural and region dependent, they've got completely different skins per region. So they might have something that represents players from Thailand. They might have something that represents players from Indonesia, etc. And so because of that, they keep things really fresh for that particular region. And then... yes, lastly, the reason why I really think it could be enduring is that they've got 100 million daily active users, which is crazy. I can't even imagine 100 million. That's like three times the population of Australia playing this game every single day. And that number hasn't really dropped. And not only that, it's only continued growing as they push into Latin America, which is one of their markets that Free Fire has started to expand into. So an example, they've got Carnival, you know, in Brazil. They've got Carnival skins for that country. You know, they've got Diwali skins as part of that as well, for the countries that celebrate Diwali. And so I think Free Fire could be one of those really enduring games because they've got such a large user base and they've started to keep it fresh and localized and relevant for particular regions.
I like the localization play, and as an example of some of the other sort of attempts to get popular skins and traction of young audiences, they did a partnership with Cristiano Ronaldo, you know, one of the most famous football players in the world, so that they do these sort of tie-ups. But inherently, I don't think these things are enduring. And the example I'd give is, and Albert, we had the discussion with global CEO of Rays, George Lucas, and he was saying how Indonesians, and I know this as well, have got a very short attention spans with some products. Like BlackBerry would have had tens of millions of users in Indonesia, and then a year or two passed, and now it's all Apple, and now it's all, you know, other phones. So Indonesians and other Southeast Asians can really shift on some of these trends, and I wouldn't be surprised if the same thing could happen here with a game which, you know, I think there's nothing inherently sustainable about it, ongoing about it, enduring about it.
I think if you look at the different network effects it's built for itself, you know, as more and more people play it, the product becomes better because you've got more servers, you know, you've got more user bases, you've got more competitive players, you can then monetize it, people are more likely to play it. You've got different content, they'll build more. So potentially, but I agree with you, like gaming can be so fickle, but it's hard to forecast because the enduring games stay enduring. Like Dota and League of Legends are old games. Counter-Strike is an old game, yet people are still playing those games. And the way Free Fire is going is that it's got all these different users. I'm looking at stats from October 2021. They had, at its peak, 345 million users, which is ridiculous on a day. And so because it's trended upwards and more people are playing it, and they haven't even reached market saturation, they're not playing in any Western countries. They're only really playing in Asia and LATAM. Like, it could be one of those incredibly enduring games.
Could be. Well, we'll have to see. We'll have to see in the future. I think the other thing I'd mention there is the hedge against this is they did see, that is, as recently acquired Phoenix Labs, which is it's a US-based, well, obviously Phoenix Labs, it's a US-based game publisher. So they know this. Like, they're trying to see if they can build the next in-house hit. But as we know, like, that's a bit of a speculative business. It might be the next runway hit, it might not be.
Yeah, and I guess that they don't have to build the next runway hit because they've got a portfolio of games. And Free Fire already is a runway hit when you've got that many players. You know, why wouldn't you, you know, want to keep milking it for what it's worth?
All right, Albert, what do you want to talk about next?
All right, so I guess, you know, we're almost at, like, our general recording time. I guess the last broad thing is probably worth discussing is, like, where does C go from here? Like, they've got this portfolio business where they've got gaming, they've got e-commerce, they've got financial services, digital payments through C Money. And, you know, as a business, this probably works out really well. They've used the learnings from gaming to inform other parts of their business, such as Shopee. Part of what underpins all three of them is transactions, and they've built a platform that enables transactions. Like, you can buy things within the game, and that's powered by C Money. And they incentivize buyers, sellers on Shopee to use C Money. Like, where does C go from here as a giant conglomerate business? Because it is one of the biggest businesses in the world, and it's doing some very interesting things.
The easy answer is they go to other markets. Like, as you mentioned, there's still market share to be had in Southeast Asia, mostly through just the organic growth of more non-internet users coming onto the internet. But that's going to be a slow sort of move. It's just going to be dependent on time moving those users on. So where their real high growth avenues are to go into other markets. And I've been really interested in some of the targets that they've got. Like, they've moved into, they're already in India. They're making moves into Brazil and Latin America. And also, they're recently launched in Europe. So, like, they're really spreading themselves out. The risk there is that all of those are very different geographics. They're going to encompass all sorts of specific and unique challenges in each. And you might wonder, are they going to spread themselves too thin? If I focus in on particularly Latin America, the big worry there is they've got an incumbent in Mercado Libre, which is one of the largest shopping apps. So this is on the Shopee side of things, e-commerce platforms in Latin America. I think they've made some inroads at the moment, and they're the second most popular shopping app in Brazil, so they can show they can compete. But the question will really be like how far they can push that in a market which is in some ways similar to Southeast Asia's, but obviously there's cultural differences there.
Yeah, it's a good point. I think the what I want to see from C is, you know, they're a mobile first company, and so they've built out a gaming product that's mobile first. They've built out a e-commerce platform that's mobile first, and that's kind of different to Alibaba, which started as a desktop app, or Amazon, which started as, you know, a desktop app or web browser app. And now they've built out a digital mobile first payments and financial services business. Trying to analogize to see what else people do mobile first, like communications. Can they build out a communications business that's mobile first? Potentially. Will they want to? I'm unsure. But where I think there's room for growth for C is basically anything a consumer does on their phone now, can C take what they've learned from other parts of their business and leverage that learning to continue building out a mobile-first platform?
Yeah, I mean, if I was the head of this multi-billion-dollar company, Albert, I probably wouldn't go that route. I don't have the privilege, so I don't get much of a say. But I would say they've got three really distinct business portfolios. They've got digital payments with C-Money, they've got Shopee with the e-commerce, and then they've got Garena with their games. That's a lot to have on your plate, and there's a lot of runway, particularly in some of these newer markets like in Latin America, where I would just focus on that, focus on what you know. I wouldn't necessarily get into telecom. To put some extra context on how they're sort of positioned in Latin America, Shopee had about 30 million monthly active users, whereas Mercado Libre, which is, you know, the top dog, as I said, has a bit over double in about 80 million unique active users. So there's still a lot of inroads to be made. Even though they're number two, they're number two by a long way.
Oh, for sure. And there's a great philosophy around like profit from the core. And right now they're making about $4 on average per player. So their ARPU, average revenue per user, on Garena is about $4. Where other more westernized gaming products hit, you know, $30 to $40 ARPU. And, you know, Garena or Free Fire has, you know, 10x, 5x the players of other games. If they could hit an ARPU of $20 per user, that's incredible growth. And that's without expanding into any other market. If they could just squeeze the core, then that's incredible growth for this business.
And even on that point, Albert, which is a great point, I've seen that their total player base, I think only 12% actually pay anything towards the game. So like they make the in-app purchases, that sort of thing. So you've got 88% of players being freeloaders. If you could find a way to monetize even a small percentage of those, then again, you're really growing the core. So huge business, lots of different ways they can grow. Those are some, I think, low-hanging fruit.
For sure, for sure. I think at some point we probably should do a very deep dive into each of these businesses, Dan, because this is a really interesting business and you probably could assess it on its merits by business unit.
All right, Albert, what's your verdict?
Yeah, I think Shopee. I think C is a very interesting business. I think it, you know, it's incredibly attractive to me. They've got a good portfolio. It's synergistic. They've got heaps of tailwinds in their favor. Like, to me, this is definitely a no-brainer, probably one of the best businesses that we've looked at personally.
Yeah, I love it just because it's also in my wheelhouse. It's in the region which I pay a lot of attention to. It's in probably like the three, wouldn't you say this is like three of the most sort of popular business segments at the moment for startups and stuff? They're in fintech, they're in gaming, and they're in e-commerce. Like, what else is there? I guess they're not in like mobility.
Well, the only
right?
thing that's missing is crypto, but I'm sure they'll get into that too.
Well, and that's exactly right. I mean, they've made no mention of it, but if you're running a digital payments wallet, it's a very easy add-on. Like Square's gone that way as well. PayPal's gone that way. I don't think the geography of Southeast Asia is ready to have that sort of significant play into crypto, but that's something that could easily be tacked on. So yeah, lots to love about C. I'm a big fan and looking forward to where they go in the next couple of years.
Yeah, interesting. That was a good episode. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you, Albert. Thank you for all the kind words. Now we're heading into the Christmas season, Albert. Anything you want to say to the listeners? I think this is going to come out the week before Christmas.
Yeah, I think this has been a really big year, and we talked about it in our like year on reflection episodes. But I think, you know, we've hit some pretty good milestones as Fresh Capital. And as we move to the Christmas break, like it is exciting to see we've done a whole year of these deep dives, kind of force ourselves to think about these businesses critically. I think there's like a bit of a flywheel effect as well, because as you analyze one e-commerce business, you can take the learnings and help you focus and analyze other e-commerce businesses. So, you know, I'm looking forward to what we do next year. I think we'll try produce a bit of content, probably more light touch content over the Christmas break to, you know, tie our listeners over, but, you know, keen to see what we do next year.
Yeah, I'd actually be interested. I mean, one of the reasons I want to run Christmas content, Albert, is to just get data points on like, do listeners sort of decrease over Christmas? I know my own personal listener behavior is I've got nothing to do over Christmas, so I really spam podcasts and I miss it and I eventually run out. You know, before New Year's, I'm already out of podcasts to listen to. So that's why I want to run it. So, I mean, look, if there's any listeners out there that know that they're not going to be listening over the Christmas period, give us a call out and we might save ourselves some work.
Nice. I've got a podcast recommendation for you, actually. We could probably talk about it offline because I just reminded me to tell you about it. Yeah.
Well, let the listeners know.
There's a podcast I really like called Acquired, which was my second most listened podcast this year, according to Spotify Wrapped. But they do really long deep dives on companies that have gone either been acquired or gone public. And they just did one on a content creator that I really like called Paki McCormack, who runs Not Boring Co. Not Boring Co. is a newsletter that Paki writes. And he went from, you know, $0 to $1 million in revenue this year or the past 18 months. And I was going to send it over to you to be like, this guy just went, you know, zero to this, talking about business strategy on Substack. And interesting to hear his kind of journey.
There you go. Business goals. Well, let's wrap up there, Albert. Thanks for listening to the Fresh Capital Podcast, a podcast that explains companies and investing in a refreshingly simple way. We'll see you next week. Bye. Thank you for listening to another episode of Fresh Capital. Every week, we provide a refreshingly simple way to learn how companies operate and how investing works. Just a reminder, all information contained in this podcast is for education and entertainment purposes only. It is not intended as a substitute for professional, financial, legal, or tax advice. The hosts of Fresh Capital are not financial professionals and are not aware of your personal financial circumstances. Any opinions expressed in the show are not recommendations or advice. Please consult a licensed financial professional before you jump in. As always, we look forward to seeing you next week. See ya!